talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leuten, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're discussing one of the most beloved, brilliant and bitingly perceptive authors of all time, Jane Austen, and we'll be debating why her novels continue to inspire readers, writers, filmmakers and scholars all around the world 250 years after her birth. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Born in England in December 1775, Jane Austen published her first novel, Sense and Sensibility, anonymously in 1811. During a short, dazzling period of creativity, she went on to complete five more major novels before her death. Her works dissected family, fortune, love and society with unmatched irony and wit. Austen was a fiercely intelligent writer whose work continues to challenge and provoke readers. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore what we can learn from Jane Austen and apply to our world today on this, the 250th anniversary of her birth. And to help us do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Janet Todd is an internationally renowned scholar and was the seventh president of Lucy Cavendish College at the University of Cambridge. The general editor of the nine-volume Cambridge edition of the works of Jane Austen, she's the author of Jane Austen, Her Life, Her Times, Her Novels, and her new book is called Living with Jane Austen. Lizzie Dunford is the director of Jane Austen's House and writes and presents regularly on Jane Austen and literary houses. And the creators of Jane Austen House have just brought out a beautifully illustrated new book, A Jane Austen Year. Professor John Mullen is Lord Northcliffe Professor of Modern English Literature at University College London and is a leading expert on 18th and 19th century literature. His books include What Matters in Jane Austen, 20 Crucial Puzzles Solved, and he's also edited Sense and Sensibility and Emma for Oxford's World's Classics. Well, you're all very welcome. And Janet, I might begin with you, and I might begin with a question about how, why does Jane Austen and her works continue to entertain, inspire, and why are her works still so loved 250 years after her birth?
It's a good question. I think she's so accessible. She changes as the culture changes. She has the ability to impress and engage us at different periods of our life and the culture at different periods of its existence. So it's about romance. Her works are about love, which is always the great subject, but it's about a great deal more, how we live with each other, how we get on with people we don't necessarily think are brilliant or clever or even good. How we live in communities, basically. And I think that's of enduring interest to everybody.
And the novels are subtle, they're nuanced, they're funny. There are mysteries in them and trying to work out who likes who and what's going on.
Exactly. And I think I've found, as I've got older, I've seen different things in them. When I was young, I didn't like when I was a child. I'm not a person who liked romance in my teen years. But when I came to it, it was an adult interest. And now I see even more than the stories and the great heroines with whom one has to identify in some way. I see the comic characters, the ones slightly on the periphery. I see Mrs. Elton in a way that I never did before, as somebody who's trying to get into society. Or I see Mrs. Norris as the least favoured of the sisters in Mansfield Park. I didn't see all that before. I just saw them as irritating characters. So I think that as I change, I see more in Jane Austen.
What would you say to someone who sees them or might be put off or alienated from the fact that they are, you know, they appear old fashioned, or the dresses and the manners, and they would see it as dated or hard to maybe get their heads around, and maybe being something that is representing a class system and a world that's alien to them today?
Well, I think you've probably got the public against you on that one, because people seem to love it. I mean, I go to events where people are all dressed up in clothes that they've made. They want to enter this fantasy Regency world. It's an escape, and really, why not? So, yes, that side of things, you could say it was dated, or you could say it was a beautiful fantasy into which we can enter. But that doesn't alter the fact that at the centre of it all is this living with other people, this coping with the follies of yourself and others, learning to laugh at what is, can be painful, things that she calls the little zigzags of embarrassment, all these, this kind of thing that we all have to face. So while they may seem, well, dated or fun to us living today, I think their central core is by no means dated.
And the books are brilliant, and they've also inspired so many filmmakers who have adapted them and given their own spin to it, whether on television or in the cinema. And it's really, I think you could almost write a history of how society has evolved through the prism of some of these adaptations. Mm. And you see what bits they're emphasising and what they're playing up and what kind of messages they're drawing from the works.
I think that's absolutely true. And it's particularly true of the favoured book, not the one that many people like best, but which is culturally favoured, Pride and Prejudice. And the films there, I think, have overshadowed the book for many people. So that in the book, Mr. Darcy is there, but he's not the central consciousness. And early readers didn't really much notice him. But with the films, with the sort of Colin Firth, Darcy mania, and so on, he has become the sort of heartthrob of the nation. And he's taken into him a lot of other characters like the Brontes, Mr. Rochester, or any number of these powerful, handsome, slightly overbearing, moody men. So that it's the films that I think that have made that character. And so they have, you can now perhaps look at the book and see that character in embryo there. But in some ways, it is the film that overshadows, I think, much of the reading of Pride and Prejudice.
And John, that is fascinating, the way Pride and Prejudice is the novel that we so closely associate with Jane Austen. And it's not Emma, it's not Persuasion, it's not Mansfield Park, that there are so many other novels that perhaps could have a claim to being her best novel, or maybe it might be the one that readers enjoy the most. What is it about Pride and Prejudice that inspires and resonates and is in the public consciousness so much?
Well, I mean, it's her second published novel, of course, and it's the one where I think she really hit her stride. You know, let's take an example. There's a moment, a famous moment, which is always preserved in the film and TV adaptations that Jan was talking about, where Mr. Darcy snubs Elizabeth at a subscription ball in Meryton, and it's the first of several dances in the book, and he's incredibly rude, incredibly rude. You remember, he says, "Not handsome enough for me. She is tolerable, but not handsome enough for me." And he lets her overhear this. And there are lots of 18th and early 19th century novels with young women at dances in them. And Elizabeth Bennet behaves as no woman in a novel before her or contemporary with her behaves. She doesn't feel mortified. She's not crushed. She doesn't cry. She doesn't have an upwelling of feminist sentiment. She goes and tells her friends and laughs about it. And it's just like a moment of release. It's incredible. It's a release, amazing release for the readers in 1813. At last, you have a palpable human being who laughs at the world, who's utterly irreverent, the most irreverent heroine there's ever been. And novelist sense have tried to outdo her and failed miserably, of course. And that moment of release captures everything about the book, I think. It's, you know, sparkling, as Jane Austen herself called it, dialogue. It's wit, it's archness, it's wonderful parade of comic monsters. But it is the first modern novel, it seems to me, in that sort of, you know, sudden encounter with an utterly credible person, heroine, who laughs at the world. Thank God.
And John, how have your students reacted and responded to Jane Austen over the years? Do they see, or do they have this image of the books being about bonnets and balls, or do they see them as being perhaps more radical and more modern and more innovative than they might have suspected?
I don't think they see them as being about bonnets and bulls at all. I think she is the first modern novelist who realizes that, who makes it obvious to us that a novel is absorbing not because it has extraordinary and unlikely events in it, but because it has pulsing human beings in it. And actually, you know, my students, they, in a way, who've taught me that, I think. Jan was talking about how she didn't really come to Jane Austen when she was young. And I'm rather the same. When I was in my teens, I read Jane Austen at school, and like lots of boys probably, I could sort of see it was sublimely well written, but I thought it was inconsequential. I sort of thought Tolstoy or Joseph Conrad was the thing, you know, guns, trips up the Congo River, battles. But what I really noticed teaching it and still notice is you can sit down in a room with, you know, 20 intelligent 20-year-olds and study a Jane Austen novel that, you know, that I've read a dozen, 15 times before. And within 10 minutes, one of the students has noticed something that I've never seen before. And I think only Shakespeare has rivaled her for that extraordinary capacity to reveal things to you which are all a product of her ingenuity in what is a supposedly well-trodden, familiar fictional ground. And I think the students recognise that as well.
And I love that idea of this being the beginning of the modern novel, and that she's very much a modern novelist. And she does innovate in the works, in the way you talk about in the book about her use of free and direct speech and the way she can filter narration through the minds of the characters. And it's really giving us empathy and an insight and a new perspective on what's going on.
Yes. It's extraordinary. It's this technique of, you know, her novels are all narrated in the third person, as it were, by Jane Austen. And yet, Virginia Woolf said, I think, a very true thing about Jane Austen, that her genius is that, in a way, she's not there at all in her novel. She's not telling you what to think. And she has this technique of bending her narrative through the minds of her characters, which means through their misapprehensions and prejudices and self-delusions. And one of, I mean, to my mind, her most complicated and satisfying novel, Emma, is written almost entirely from the point of view of a heroine who's wrong about almost everything. And there's no author there, as there would be in a George Eliot novel, to sort of tell you this, to help you, to guide you. You have to learn with the character what is true, what is false, what is mere wishfulness. And it's extraordinarily sophisticated. And novelists throughout the 19th century sort of develop this technique, and some of them, you know, like Henry James and Flaubert, made a, you know, went on about it in their letters or their commentaries in quite sort of boastful ways. But actually, Jane Austen invented this technique more or less at a little table in Hampshire, without the advice or the knowing counsel of other writers. She didn't know any other writers, and she just did it. And there's something kind of miraculous about that, I think.
Lizzie, tell us about Jane Austen's house. Where is it? What can you see there? And when did she live there?
The house is in a little Hampshire village called Chawton. It was Austen's final home. She moved there in 1809 and she left in May 1817 and she passed away in July 1817. And it is so deeply significant because it was during those years that she was living there that she revised or wrote from scratch every single one of her novels. So you have this period of extraordinary creativity. Every single one of those novels comes to their final form within that space and within that time period. And the house has been open as a museum since 1949 and able to collect a whole range of really astonishing artifacts from first editions, Austen letters. One of the real highlights of our collection is a series of letters Austen writes when she receives her copy of Pride and Prejudice. So you see her as an author in these letters, her reaction to having the book herself. She called it her darling child. We know she read it aloud in the house with her mother. For the first performance of Pride and Prejudice was by Jane Austen herself in the drawing room at Jane Austen. And today you can come and stand in that space under, you know, the recreated wallpaper, so as she would have known it. So it's this extraordinary place that was a site of intense creativity, continues to, we hope, be inspiring it, but you can also follow in her footsteps and see objects that she would have known. And as John says, at the heart of this is this tiny little writing table that she wrote at. And she wrote in these small booklets to create these extraordinary novels. So it's this, I find it a very magical place, but I am biased, but it's this place that so much came out from. That's very important.
And is it true that the house then appears in some of the novels? Does it appear, is it, for example, Barton Cottage in Sense and Sensibility?
We think it both is and it isn't Barton Cottage. So Barton Cottage is where the Dashwoods escape to. It's a refuge for them, in the same way that Austen's house was a place of sanctuary for the Austen women after a period of housing uncertainty. Barton Cottage is in the rolling Devon Hills. It's quite isolated, whereas Jane Austen's house is on the edge of a really busy main road at the time. Now it's been bypassed. But there are some structural similarities. So there is a central corridor and two drawing rooms, 60 square on either side, which is exactly how Barton Cottage is described. So there are certainly elements of it. And that's quite rare in Austen's writing, to see something that is, she doesn't describe places very much. And Barton Cottage is an unusually precise description, and there are elements of it that certainly match the house.
And the house tells all of these wonderful stories using the objects, using the rooms, using Austen's own words, and all together they animate her world. And the book of Jane Austen Year does that as well. And how do visitors respond to that? Who goes to the house, and what does it mean for them to follow in Jane Austen's footsteps?
We have a whole range of visitors coming to the house. We have people who, John and Jan, who just know the books inside out, who they're part of their lives. They are their lives. Austen is so important to people within that. We have people who've just seen one episode of Miss Austen on BBC and thought they'd come and see it. So it's a real range of people. I think for everybody, it has a spark of inspiration, a spark of interest, and to be following on, you know, the very floorboards that Austen walked while she was composing and writing things is extraordinary. But for those who Austen has that really deep, intense meaning, it's quite an intense experience. We have people that will sometimes come and leave flowers. We have various places around the house where people can record their responses to the novels, and sometimes they are intensely moving. You know, Austen has a great impact on people's well-being. And as Jan says, she is an escape. And so she's often there for people. People turn to her novels at times of their own troubles or stress, and to kind of get that sense of pace and rhythm and catharsis, all of those things that come through them through following the heroine's journey. So it can be for people quite emotive.
Janet, I really enjoyed reading your new book, Living with Jane Austen, and the way you explore what it has been to be engaging, to be reading, to be enjoying the works of Jane Austen over your life, and a very moving reflection on how Austen has meant different things to you at different stages in your life, and sometimes a source of comfort, sometimes work that challenges you, sometimes something that leads to greater self-understanding or an awareness of the world. And it is a great way of exploring and reflecting on your own life through the means of Jane Austen's works.
Well, thank you. Yes, I think it has been when I look back. Also, I've moved jobs a lot and I've moved continents a lot. And I've looked at the different ways we've tried to fit Jane Austen into what we want and how she won't allow it. You know, she sits there and lets us rumble around while there's a kind of wisdom in the way that she addresses us, because I think she does, perhaps unlike John, I think that she does in the way subtly address us from the books. But it was quite interesting. I was a biographer more of Mary Wollstonecraft than of Jane Austen, and I did bring her into the book as an example of a sort of committed feminist writer who totally lacked the kind of novelistic invention that is Jane Austen's forte. Because I wanted to suggest that some of our efforts to make Jane Austen say what we want are somewhat misguided. You know, I remember in second wave feminism, which was very much my period in the 1970s in America, we wanted her to be far more feminist and ideologically committed than she is. And so we kept trying to read against the grain. And I don't think succeeded there. But then when we let her speak to us, I think we then moved on, you know, and realized that her wisdom is greater than ours, in other words, and it is her very skepticism her sense of openness to all views and to all temperaments. That is her real power. And that if we can engage with that, or she lets us engage with that, then we can take a moral and a political message, but it's a subtle one, and it's something that we have to work on ourselves. So I used Mary Wollstonecraft, whom I admire enormously, as something of a foil to that more, to the sort of subtle, complex, creative, malleable, flexible genius of Jane Austen.
And I do think it is fascinating the way you do pair them in the book. And it mightn't be an obvious relationship for some people. And I wonder, how would you answer the question about whether Austen was a feminist? You know, she mightn't have seen herself in those terms, but she certainly believed in women's agency and intelligence. Yeah. And perhaps things are perhaps more coded in the works.
Well, I don't know what a feminist is, if it isn't Jane Austen in a way. I mean, if she believes in the intellectual equality of men and women, but she also knows that she's living in a, to use the old word, the patriarchal society, and that if women are to flourish and to be contented in this world, then they have to make certain adjustments to it. But that doesn't mean that they believe in those adjustments, but they make them. It's like having those manners of civility that she shows us over and over again. No, you don't really believe what you're having to say, but there's a kind of appropriate social lying that eases your way through life. That doesn't mean that your inner life cannot be free and entirely liberated. I mean, what John said about Elizabeth Bennet is true of all of them. It's true of the one, the heroine most disliked, Fanny Price of Mansfield Park, whose sort of moral fibre can be a little off-putting. But at the same time, the point yet again is that whatever is surrounding her, she has that inner freedom that all of Jane Austen's heroines have. But the other reason I actually brought in Mary Wollstonecraft was to make a point, which I think now that I'm old, I see more and more, is that your precise moment of coming to sort of adulthood, the moment that her heroines are at, you know, 20, 21, you get sort of not stuck in it, but it's a very impressionable age for anyone. And to be born, you know, what, 15 or 20 years before Jane Austen makes Mary Wollstonecraft of another generation. And I think what I was trying to do with the memoir part of my book is suggest that my attitudes, my love of Jane Austen, all my other moral fiber, moral attitudes, shall we say, and social beliefs come from coming of age at that point. They may be modified, but they don't totally change. And Mary Wollstonecraft was born before the French Revolution. She was excited about what politics could do, about a far more utopian world in which everybody could be equal, when men and women could be totally equal. Jane Austen is living after the failure of those ideals. And I think she has, in a sense, a wiser and more sceptical view of what politics can do. But that doesn't mean that she is any less feminist in her inner life and her belief in women than Mary Wollstonecraft.
And do you think that Fanny Price needs to be rescued and rehabilitated from the charges of being dull, and that her moral courage and her character should be celebrated a little bit more?
I don't think she so much. I think we have to rescue ourselves from our views. You know, it's so easy to love Elizabeth Bennet, as of course Jane Austen loved her and thought that nobody could dislike her. How could they? But Fanny Price is hard to like initially, but she does stand for the centre of that book. She does have principles that none of the others has, but she's also a presentation of a young girl in fits of jealousy, struggling with her inner life to control, you know, moments of really intense horror at what's happening to her. And I think you can take a lot out of that. So I don't know that we need to rescue her as rescue our immediate response to that book, which is a really great book. I agree with John that Emma is my favourite too. But Mansfield Park has parts of it, and well, a whole, that is probably second to Emma in complexity and beauty.
Well, we are talking about Jane Austen and her works tonight on this, the 250th anniversary of her birth. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking about sex, money and blunders in her works, as well as the truth behind whether she had an Irish boyfriend. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the life and work of Jane Austen on this, the 250th anniversary of her birth. Our panel of experts, Professor Janet Todd, general editor of the 9-volume Cambridge edition of the works of Jane Austen and the author of the brilliant new book, Living with Jane Austen, Lizzie Dunford, the director of Jane Austen's House, and the creators there have put together a wonderful new book, A Jane Austen Year, and Professor John Mullen, the Lord Northcliffe Professor of Modern English Literature at the University College London and a leading expert in 18th and 19th century literature, whose books include What Matters in Jane Austen, 20 Crucial Puzzles Solved. Well, John, we might start back on some of those 20 crucial puzzles, because you ask some wonderful questions like whether there's sex in the novels, how much does money matter, and how much money is enough. You talk about the misunderstandings and the blunders, and it really are, they're very interesting ways of teasing out some of the nuances, some of maybe the more hidden aspects, or maybe some of the books, some of the elements that are underneath the surface.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I hope it's, I mean, you make it slightly sound as though I was sort of, you know, being ingenious, thinking of this way of doing things, but actually it's all her, it's not me. It's all Jane Austen, because over the years I've done talks on Jane Austen, and sometimes if it's the Jane Austen Society that asks me to do a talk, they will ask you a long time in advance before you've really written the talk or planned it. And I got into the habit of just sort of choosing something which I knew was in Jane Austen's novels and hoping that it would turn out to be interesting when a year later I actually got round to prepare the talk. And what I discovered over and over again, I remember saying to somebody, oh, I'll do a talk about weather in Jane Austen, because I remember thinking there's two or three episodes, aren't there, where the weather's very important in Sense and Sensibility. Marianne goes out for a walk and says, oh, it's bound to be fair. And of course, you know, there's a storm, she falls over, Willoughby picks her up, carries her into the house, and then this sort of disastrous romance blossoms. And of course, when you just take any little thing and pursue it through her novels, you find that there's these really beautiful sort of patterns of connectedness. And because the answer to the question, what matters in Jane Austen, is everything. Everything she does is woven into the pattern of her fiction. So the big questions, you know, about money or sex or how old people are or their property or whatever, you expect those to produce interesting answers. But, you know, why is it dangerous to go to the seaside, sit down and read her novels to try and answer that question? You find out fascinating things.
And I suppose I teased the listeners by saying we would talk about sex in the novels, and you do have a chapter there as one of your puzzles. And is it there in the euphemisms? Is it there in the elopements? And is it maybe sometimes there in slightly more obvious ways?
I think, well, it's there in obvious ways in the novel that Jan was talking about, Mansfield Park, which I very much agree. I think it's a very deep and complicated novel, and one which, I think that's the one which one comes to appreciate more and more over the years. And of course, Fanny Price's cousin, Maria Bertram, marries a man that she doesn't love. In fact, she marries a man, extraordinary thing, she marries a man because she despises him, Mr. Rushworth, in order to show the man she really fancies, Henry Crawford, that she doesn't care about him anymore. And then as a married woman, she has an adulterous affair with Henry Crawford, and this leads to public scandal and, very rare thing in the early 19th century, a divorce. And so that sort of sex plot is very explicit. But often, and for the readers, of course, in the second decade of the 19th century, this would have been perhaps clearer, there is implicitly sex in the novels. I mean, one really obvious example, of course, is Pride and Prejudice. You know, it's really important to understand that Lydia, when she elopes with Wickham, I mean, it's not strictly speaking elopement, because an elopement was taken to mean running away to get married. You know, it's often in Scotland where you could do it more easily. But actually, she goes off with Wickham, who is a practiced rake, almost 10 years older than her, to an apartment in London where they live for a month and a half. You've got to remember, she is only just past her 16th birthday. And it's clear, you know, there's this great moment where they come back after Mr. Darcy has essentially paid Wickham to marry her, and they come back to Longbourn, to the Bennet's house, and Elizabeth is agog to see how Lydia is behaving. And of course, she's not at all mortified or crushed by her near disastrous experience. And it says that Lydia is still very fond of her husband. And that word fond, I think, is a sort of code word for sexually enamored. And she's, you know, it's really clear from the plot that Lydia has gone off with this man and, you know, has had lots of very enjoyable but very ill-advised sex before she ever gets to the altar. So there are occasions when you're really asked and expected to understand what's been going on and what the sexual relations between characters, which aren't actually specified, have been.
Lizzie, I wonder, do you think that the routine and rhythm of life in the house in those final 8 years of her life helped support her creativity? The way the house was run by Cassandra, she was able to focus on her writing. There was comfort and stability and something that she hadn't really experienced before.
Definitely. And it seems to be that the household was almost set up to support Austen to write. She'd been writing since she was a teenager. She'd first started the drafts of Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility and Northanger Abbey when she was at the childhood home in Steventon. You then have a period where she doesn't really write apart from The Watsons, a fragment, but it's sort of hit and miss. When she does come to Chawton, to Jane Austen's house, you have this intense flourishing, and it seems to be considered, it seems to be planned. And she's, again, there is something quite interesting, fascinating about the way that Austen's life is in contrast to her heroine. She lived in this sort of very female-centered world. The house is lived in with her mother, her sister Cassandra, their sister-in-law, Martha Lloyd, and they live together and have this incredibly supportive, productive household, really. And Jane is producing these extraordinary works. Cassandra, a very talented artist. Martha is looking after the house. Mrs. Austen loves digging her potato patch. So it's this house where they come together and support each other. And at the heart of it is Jane writing. So yes, having that routine, having that space, having, again, you know, there's such a dialogue across the centuries between Austen and Virginia Woolf, having that room of her own, that space, mental, physical, to be able to write, seems to be so crucial for her.
And Lizzie, the wonderful book, A Jane Austen Year, has a reproduction of the portrait miniature of Tom Lefroy. And he's the Irishman who danced with Jane Austen and caught her attention in, I think it was 1796, certainly in the 1790s. And always speculation about whether he was partly the inspiration for Darcy and so on. So tell us about this Irishman. Tell us about the connection. And tell us, of course, about the fact that Jane Austen never married. So people sometimes look to these figures as possible great loves of her life.
Yes. So Tom Lefroy was the nephew of one of Austen's neighbours. He was Irishman, Protestant Huguenot Irishman, and he was studying law, came over and spent a few weeks, one Christmas, in Hampshire, not far from where Austen was growing up. They met a few balls, they danced, and one of the reasons why this sort of part of Austen's life is so important and so significant is because it's recorded in the first two letters that exist by Austen. There's only a handful of letters, 161, a big handful, 161 letters of Austen surviving. And the first two from January 1796 record this meeting with Tom Lefroy. And she describes how they flirt, how they behave outrageously, how he runs away when she goes to visit him at his niece. At his aunt's, then he come and see her. It does come a little bit later. And she does in this letter say that she is expecting an offer in the course of the last ball. But she also said that he's going to go away and her tears flow at the melancholy idea. Now, it can be seen, it can be read as, you know, tears are flowing. She does expect an offer. You can read those words straight. However, Austen is also a master. You know, even at 20, 21, she has still got a satirical voice. And that letter is not tear-stained. We own it jointly with the Bodleian at Jane Austen's house, and I can assure you there are no tear stains on this. But it is slightly more complex. You know, a few years later, she records how she and her father are visiting again her neighbour, who is Tom's aunt, and she's too embarrassed to ask about him, and her father asks for her. So there's something there. There's something, it's probably not, I do not believe it was a grand romance. Having read some of Lefroy's letters from later in life, they are quite different. They're very different people. Austen always, in spite of her great genius, there was a lightness to her, and that doesn't present in Lefroy's letters. They seem to have very different religious approaches, which would have mattered hugely at that time. And Austen doesn't marry. She has the chance to marry. She is proposed to in the early 1800s by a man called Harris Bigwither, who was a landowner. He was brother of her great friend. If she'd said yes, she would have been the lady of the manor, and she would have had financial stability in a home for the rest of her life, which at the time when she was pregnant was uncertain. And she does say yes in the evening, and she sleeps on it, and then in the morning she says no. And Jane, she's staying there with her sister, and they get her brother James to take them all the way back to Bath, and she never marries. But we have to remember at this time, you know, Austen was working to be an author from the point when she was 11. She was writing and she was practicing. And even in the very first things that she writes when she's so young, she declares herself the author of them. She writes dedications. And at this point, when women married, they ceased to legally exist as individuals. You couldn't sign your name on a contract. You couldn't just be anymore. And she'd also seen a lot of her sister-in-laws die in childbirth. This was quite a dangerous time to be married. It was complicated. And through staying independent and through her marriage, she could become the author that she wanted to be in a way that would have been far, far more difficult for her if she had married. So it's a complicated, you can look at it one way and go, oh, she never married because she didn't find the great love of her life, or because Tom Lefroy was ripped away. You can look at that. You know, you could see that. Or you could also see this incredibly dedicated woman who knew who she wanted to be to write. There are potentials to see both. I would potentially very much come down the side of this is a woman who wanted to be an author, whose children, she explicitly describes her books as her children, rather than anything else.
Janet, how successful was Jane Austen in her own lifetime? I'm looking at the title page of Sense and Sensibility, published in 1811. It's in that a Jane Austen yearbook, and her name isn't on it. Instead, it says by a lady. And I wonder, in her lifetime, how well was she known? How successful were the books? And when she died, how much of an impact did that make?
Well, she was appreciated by people of great sense and knowledge, you know, a few very good readers. But compared with her contemporaries, compared with Frances Burney a little before, and who goes right through her time, and compared with the person who came into writing novels and whom she thought was a bit unkind to come in as a rival, Walter Scott, she's not known at all. I mean, these people are household names. Jane Austen is not. But amongst the discerning few, she was quite well known. She wanted her novels to be read and appreciated, but she didn't seek out celebrity. When she had the chance to meet other authors, she often pulled back. Madame de Stael is an example. So it's very difficult to say. It took a long time for her to be very much appreciated during the 19th century, but there are always these famous people who did read her and see how extraordinary she was and what an influence she was having over other people. I think sometimes, in fact, some particularly men would push Jane Austen on other writers, like on Charlotte Bronte, saying, look, try to be like this. And of course, Charlotte Bronte found that offensive and said, listen, I can do a lot more than she can do, and I'm quite different, as she was. But it's very difficult to say exactly where she takes off. She goes into into sort of popular fiction by going into the sort of library, the train library, once the trains got going. And then the place at which most people seem to see her total popularity coming is when her nephew, James Edward Austin Lee, now an old man, or an elderly man, decides to write a life of his aunt, making her into something of a ladylike Victorian spinster. And this made her extraordinarily popular. Now, whether you can say that this is when it happened or whether it was moving on is difficult to say. And from then onwards, she goes on up and up and up. And it's very interesting to see that Walter Scott, the one who was so very, very popular during her time, has rather gone down and down. So that you go into bookshops and you see huge numbers of complete works of Walter Scott. You're not seeing complete works of Jane Austen because they'll be snapped up. But I want to stress, I think some people always appreciated what she was doing, though it's very interesting to see in letters and so on just how much people go on to characters. And I'm always impressed at the fact that they didn't see what we see. They didn't jump on the aspects that we so much like, which again suggests how plastic and malleable and flexible Jane Austen is. But they loved often the comic characters in a way that, to some extent, I think we do less so. But as I think I mentioned already, as I've come into old age, I'd like these even more. And it's this social comedy as well as the psychological realism that I think comes to the fore. But she's not been ever totally out of the public eye, but the enormous popularity does seem to come from about the 1870s. And now the global Jane Austen comes, of course, with the films and with all the different ways in which Jane Austen is packaged. The fanfic, the sequels and the prequels and the merchandise. You know, she's now a brand as well as just a writer.
And Janet, what do you make of some of those fan fiction pieces and the prequels and the sequels, and when they add in zombies to it, and you have serious writers like P.D. James doing novels based on some of the characters and stories, and you have continuations. Do you approve of them? Do you like them? Are you a little bit suspicious of them?
Well, they're not exactly to my taste, but I see no harm in them. I see no reason why you should not do these things. It keeps her alive. It keeps her in the public eye. And the novels are in no way diminished by any of them. Sometimes one may think the authors of them a little odd, that they feel that it's necessary to put, I can't remember what goes into Sense and Sensibility. It was either werewolves or something like that. A sea monster, I think it was. You might think, well, why bother? But it doesn't really diminish the books any more than 1,000 men and women dressing up in Regency gear and walking down the streets of Bath in September diminishes them. It may be that some of those people don't read the novels, and that's a shame. But if they do, it's two different activities. And it remains of interest to our culture that we have made her into this. I mean, that's a whole subject in itself, as well as the works of Jane Austen. But I think it can all live together. It's a very broad church.
It's a very broad church. Well, we're going to take another quick break now. When we come back, we'll be trying to assess the legacy of Jane Austen and find out what we can learn from her work. So stay with us on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the life and work of Jane Austen, and this year marks the 250th anniversary of her birth. I'm rejoined by Professor Janet Todd, the internationally renowned scholar whose new book is called Living with Jane Austen. Lizzie Dunford, the director of Jane Austen's House and the creators there, have put together a wonderful and beautifully illustrated book, A Jane Austen Year. And Professor John Mullen, Professor of English Literature at University College London and the author of What Matters in Jane Austen, 20 Crucial Puzzles Solved. John, can I ask you about the legacy and about, I suppose, the significance, the importance, and I suppose what Jane Austen means for us today in the 21st century?
Well, I think part of her legacy is that the story that Jan was telling of her popularity goes on into the 20th century and becomes a story, I think, of her influence on other novelists. So, I mean, one thing that happens which I think was not very much happening in the 19th century, but that happens in the 20th century and is still happening, is that you can see over and over again how much British, I think particularly, but sometimes American novelists owe to her techniques and her plots. And, you know, it's now no surprise, you know, if you pick up a modern novel and it's got an epigraph from Jane Austen. One of the novels, I don't know about in Ireland, but one of the modern-ish novels most often studied by sixth formers for A-level English literature is Ian McEwan's Atonement. I sometimes say the quiz question to students, what's the first sentence of Atonement? And they try and remember a sentence by Ian McEwan, but it's not actually. It's a long epigraph from Austen's Northanger Abbey. And if you understand, if you've read that and understand the plot, you understand much better what's going on in the Ian McEwan novel you're about to read. You see that over and over again. So I think she's become a sort of model for novelists and to some extent for sort of students and academics at university of what an utterly unerring control of technique and sentence structure can be like. And she has become sort of a touchstone, really, for the sort of the power of style and technique over subject matter. So, and I just see no sign of that ending. So alongside the story you've been referring to of her popularity on film and TV, I've seen in my own lifetime an extraordinary rise in her prestige amongst writers, but also, you know, on university syllabuses and amongst students and teachers. And nobody condescends to Jane Austen anymore, I can tell you that.
In the introduction to your book, you say that Shakespeare and Dickens are the only other English authors who can rival her continuing international appeal. And that's a good trinity to be part of.
It is. Although, of course, probably as part of this odd story of her reputation, Dickens, who owned a copy of her novels, because he owned a huge sort of 300-volume set of English novelists, there's no evidence that he ever read Jane Austen. But yes, I mean, that's not in a way my judgment. It's almost my report on my experience. I'm sure Jan's found this as well. If you go in different countries and talk about writers and go to literary events, Jane Austen's reach, as it were, is just incredible. Not only have people heard about her, but they know something of the stories. And of course, they may have come to that secondhand through film and TV. But still, there is, I mean, what I find is this extraordinary conviction that if you go different places in the world, people are so often convinced, if they have read her novels, that their characters and their plots are somehow more applicable to their own countries than to the country in which they were written and first published, you know. And so I've had people who, you know, been brought up in India saying, oh, we understand Pride and Prejudice much better than you're ever going to. I know I have a Korean friend who said, oh, yes, Mansfield Park makes perfect sense if you come from South Korea. And of course, that's an illusion in a way, but it's a testimony to the what is just the fact, the universality of her stories and characters.
And it's also the universality of her message. And Janet, you show in your work how studying Austen, enjoying Austen, reading Austen can help us understand our own bodies, our environment. She teaches us about patience, humour, beauty, the meaning of home, the meaning of life.
Yeah, I think she does. I would add to John's point about the fact that she allows us to connect with other people too. I mean, there is a sort of collectivity. It's like talking about the weather. It's always a subject that is available. And perhaps, well, certainly more with women than with men, you can be pretty sure that most people of any education at all will know of Jane Austen. You can refer to her. You can refer at least to Pride and Prejudice. It makes for a kind of community of reference, which is very, very attractive. But to take your other point about learning from it, I Yes, what you mentioned, I think it is there. I actually have quite a penchant for improving literature. I've always quite liked it. I like to be told. I think it was my, you know, my Baptist background. You know, I've listened to sermons and I quite like it. Now, she doesn't do this ever, but from the books and from her letters as well, I get a sense of coping with life, having exactly fortitude, a word that she actually shares with Mary Wollstonecraft. And one of the big elements of fortitude is patience. Patience with other people, patience with what you your lot is in life, and patience with yourself. And I think, again, I mean, because I'm getting old, I have become old, I did perhaps spend more time than I might otherwise have done on Jane Austen's versions of ailments and the unruly body controlling it, as also with death. And with all these subjects, she approaches them with a kind of mild severity, I might say. You know, she shows that she understands how difficult it is to control the self, to let the mind control the body, to not to give in to hypochondria, not to grumble about common ailments. She has a bracing attitude to all this. And she does it mostly, of course, through humour. And it seems to me that that is a very good lesson in life. I mean, she is utterly remarkable in that almost on her deathbed, she writes a comic poem. Now, does she do this because she is keeping herself going? Well, in pain. Or, I mean, of course, she doesn't know she's on her deathbed. Nobody knows the actual hour, but she knows that she's very ill. Or is she, even at the end, trying to mitigate the sadness for her relatives, for the people who love her? And is she trying always to entertain them? Because that is what goes through the whole of her life. The little girl who was the youngest daughter in this big family, writing these very, very funny adult-directed stories. All her life she has entertained with her imaginative worlds. And perhaps that's not a bad way of going, keeping the humour and the ability to think about other people, even when you're in great pain.
Lizzie, I will leave the final word to you. Jane Austen herself described Pride and Prejudice as her darling child. If you were to recommend one of her works to our listeners, would it be the great classic and the famous one, Pride and Prejudice, or would you recommend one of the others we've been talking about?
And I think you should read them all. I particularly have I love Mansfield Park, but I would always start with Pride and Prejudice. It sparkles, and yet there's so much more with it as well. So start with Pride and Prejudice and then read everything.
My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts for bringing the work of Jane Austen to life for us. Professor Janet Todd, the general editor of the 9-volume Cambridge edition of the works of Jane Austen and the author of that excellent new book, Living with Jane Austen. Lizzie Dunford, the director of Jane Austen's House, and their new book is A Jane Austen Year. And Professor John Mullen of University College London, whose book is What Matters in Jane Austen, 20 Crucial Puzzles Solved. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to Marais O'Sullivan, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.